pop culture to politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great nation, despite the fact that there is great agreement, whether you're left or you're right or you're center or you're up and down, that America seems to have lost its way. That there's a great deal of confusion in the path or paths that this nation is choosing to take. So how do you find your way again as a nation? How do you find your way again as an individual? Tim Egan, who is a columnist for the New York Times, I think actually the best and most readable and most important of the liberal columnists with the New York Times, has a new book, which is a departure from all of his previous best-selling books about American history. It's very personal. It's called Pilgrimage to Eternity, From Canterbury to Rome in Search of a Faith. And we'll talk with Tim about how he found his way on this pilgrimage, what he learned about his own Catholic faith and about the situation of what it means to be a committed Catholic in this moment of history, and also his suggestions about a way that America could perhaps offer some kind of pilgrimage or some other means for finding our way as a country. Tim, congratulations on the book, and it's great to talk to you.
Oh, thank you, Michael. It's great to be with you, and thanks for your kind words.
Well, the book is highly readable. It's very personal. And, of course, the very first question that one could ask is to cut to the chase. Did you find what you were looking for when you began setting out on foot, and going on foot is a very important part of it, on this long and ancient pilgrimage?
So I don't believe in spoiler alerts, and you as a movie reviewer, I don't believe in spoilers, I should say, and Michael, you as a superb movie reviewer know that you don't give away the ending. So I'm not going to tease you too much, but I'm also not going to tell you what my ultimate conclusions were. But I'll tell you this, I did reach some closure on some things. I did resolve some things. I did get rid of some of my doubts. You know, I started out as somewhat of an agnostic. I call myself a lapsed but listening Catholic. And I ended up in a much different place because I did what I think a lot of us should do at some point in our lives. You know, we let our thinking get sort of lazy. We sort of fall into these patterns. We don't really try to step out of a routine. And I tried to step out of my routine in following the Via Francigena, a great pilgrimage trail through Central Europe that used to be the most used, most traveled pilgrimage trail through the medieval days. I really forced some of these issues. So, you know, I guess it's a little bit like the U2 song, I Still Haven't Found What I'm Looking For, but with an asterisk, because I did close out a lot of things.
Okay. First of all, describe this route. I should say, by the way, your book, Pilgrimage to Eternity, which is posted right up at our website at michaelmedved.com, it comes together with a map showing your route, which was the traditional route, all the way from Canterbury Cathedral to Rome. When did this begin as a route of pilgrimage?
So the route was first charted in the year 990. Wow. By the Archbishop of Canterbury named Sigeric the Serious, one of these great medieval names that often tell you, like Native American names, everything you need to know about the person. And he walked to Rome to see the Pope. And thereafter, and he marked his places along the way. And thereafter, and at the height of the medieval age, upwards of 1 million people, or just average people for the most part, walked this very treacherous 1,000-plus-mile journey. I mean, you go from Canterbury, you cross the English Channel, you walk through the flatlands of Flanders Fields, where now there's so many graves from the First World War. You go through the magnificent Champagne country. You go to the shrines of Christianity, like the town of Reims, where every king of France was crowned by this oil from brought down from this dove of God. Into Switzerland, where the Reformation, of course, took place, up into the high point of the Alps, 8,000 feet, which reminded me quite a bit of our own Cascade Mountains, except for the food was much better at the end of the day. through Tuscany, the Piedmont, and Lazio, and ending in Rome. And so pilgrims did it for 1,000 years because it was a way to have all your sins removed. You could get a plenary indulgence from the Pope if you walk this distance. And now it's been revived. It's a European cultural trek that these four countries that hold the Via Francigena recognize. It's posted fairly well. It's a magnificent country. I urge any of your listeners who want to do a great adventure to do some part of the Via Francigena. Again, less well-known than the Camino de Santiago. And, you know, the reason people went on pilgrimages was not just to have all their sins forgiven, but to look inside themselves and to test themselves. And I was, you know, I guess I was going through somewhat of a, I hate this term, but a spiritual midlife crisis, and I wanted to force these issues. And a pilgrimage was a way to do that.
Well, part of it had to do with the passing of your mom, right?
Yeah, it was a really horrible thing. I was very close to my mother. I'm one of seven kids. And she was a progressive Catholic, a great reader, a great lover of history, a great lover of the outdoors, a great lover of just being a contrarian. And she died suddenly of glioblastoma, which is a brain cancer, and it really broke me. And I held her hand on her deathbed where literally she slipped away into another world. And she's a very devout Catholic, very devout. And on her deathbed, she told me, I'm not feeling it. I'm not sure. And this is hard for me to talk about, but she said, I'm not sure what's ahead in the next world. I don't think anyone is, of course. But as I let her slip away, it got me thinking, you know, what about my own faith? I mean, what? Why not? I'd let it go sort of lazy, and I'd let my thinking go lazy, I should say. I'd gotten out of spiritual shape, and her passing really prompted me to look at the things that animated so much of her life. At the very end of her life, she was still doing charity work, still working with St. Vincent de Paul for the less known, the people that Christ said you need to be respond to in order to get into heaven. And so I was very inspired by that. That was one of the jumping off points.
And again, don't want to give too much of this away, but part of what moved you was other people you encountered along the way.
Absolutely. First of all, I was inspired by fellow pilgrims. And one of the great things about going on a pilgrimage, whether you just do a 100-mile section of the Via Francigena or the whole thing as I did, is meeting other people along the way. It was not just, you know, pilgrims of a certain age, people who decided, like myself, to force these issues, but a fair amount of young people as well. And one of the terms you hear is this term deep walking. And people say that a pilgrimage is a way for the young to do religion. But then also, I really dialed down on the religious figures from the past and great people who you have to think about because you go through their shrines, from Henry VIII to the Archbishop of Canterbury to Joan of Arc to Francis of Assisi to the new Pope. And this is one spoiler I will give you. My wife joined me for the last 100 miles of the journey, walking to Rome through Lazio, from Siena basically to Rome. My wife is Jewish, and so we had these very fascinating conversations, which we hadn't really had for a long time, as we pounded our way toward Rome.
And your wife, who I've had the privilege of meeting and speaking with and working with, is the very well-known, well-respected political journalist in the Seattle area, Joni Balter. And it's okay to say that, isn't it? I don't think it's a secret. You've been married for a while.
35 years.
Okay, that's almost exactly like us. Our 35th anniversary is coming up in January.
Good for you. One of the questions I was asked in order to stay at a monastery one night was the abbot drilled me down and he said, have you ever been divorced? And I said, no, I haven't. He goes, do you have any kids? I said, yes, I have two kids. He says, and how's your marriage? I said, I'm doing okay. You know, quite. it was quite an interrogation, but it got me my bunk at night in an ancient monastery.
Well, if your wife is doing 100 miles of pilgrimage with you right into Rome, again, the book is so rich in terms of personal reflections, historical reflections, as you would expect from a writer like Tim Egan, whose most recent book, The Immortal Irishman, was a truly a vivid and lucid story of an amazing historical life here in the United States. And let me use that as a transition to taking us away from pilgrimage in Europe, the pilgrimage to eternity, from Canterbury to Rome in search of a faith. That's the name of the new book by Tim Egan. To talk about the book of history that we're writing right now in this country. You talk in your book about the crisis in the Catholic Church. You say it could be the worst crisis since the Reformation. But here in this country, there's a widespread feeling that we're in the midst of a crisis. And I know that to some extent, at least you share that. Do you have some perspective on a way out to restore that sense of good fortune and blessing and purpose that has been part of our American heritage?
Boy, that's a fantastic question and a very difficult question, Michael. I mean, you and I are both time travelers. We love history. We love to step out of our present day and put ourselves in another era. And that gives us perspective. And so, you know, you mentioned my perspective on the church right now and on the crisis they're going through. And you hear a lot of talk today that we are in, you know, our worst period of disunity, probably since the late 1850s. People also compare it to the highly partisan era of the 1790s and the early dawn of the 19th century, when the partisan press was at its height, and back when we had dueling and Hamilton was shot. You know what? I've been reading a lot of recent American histories, and I'm not so sure I'm ready to say we're at one of those 1850s type moments. But as to your question, the only thing I can think of that can get us out of it is when we have a common adversary. And, you know, you saw this. I mean, people think the Depression was everybody was singing and getting along while going through hard times. I wrote a book about the Depression called The Worst Hard Time. And in fact, it was a terrible time for families. Mothers stopped having babies. It was the lowest birth rate of the 20th century. And there was a lot of division, too. What got us out of that was World War II. We had a common enemy. And so, you know, when there's a foe to face that looks bigger than our individual disputes, it often will bring us out of it. Now, I don't know what that is right now. You're a better time traveler than I. I've dipped into, you know, Victorian England to follow my Irishman. I've dipped into the 1930s with the Dust Bowl, and now I've dipped into church history. But there's some areas I haven't spent much time in order to answer that.
Well, but one thing I agree with you about. I mean, I do think people who compare this, saying, "Oh, this is the worst since the Civil War," are people who aren't old enough, by and large, to have lived through the 1960s. I mean, in the 1960s, there were people who were blowing up, the mathematics building got blown up at University of Wisconsin by some American revolutionary who ended up killing a graduate student who was working late.
That's a great point. Great point.
Well, there was real violence. You remember the Symbionese Liberation Army? It was a crazy, awful, awful, awful time. And I mean, one of the things that I find most nauseating right now is the 60s nostalgia. I mean, I'm happy the 60s are over, and I don't think we have a repeat of that, because this would be my question, and I don't know if you have a sense of this, Tim Egan, is that in the 60s there was a very, very fervent, clearly focused disagreement on basically everything between the hippies and the hard hats, is the way it was characterized. And I don't know if that's true today. There's broad agreement in the country. There's broad agreement about most things, and except for the personalities of our politicians. And that's one of the things I find so regrettable, is that I don't know what we're arguing about.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And, you know, now I'm a little younger than you. I came of age in the 70s, but I worked on a farm, and I worked in an aluminum mill. I was a member of the Steelworkers Union, an aluminum factory in Spokane, Washington. It was a very hard job. So I was around all these blue-collar guys while I was going to school. I mean, I went to the University of Washington, and I spent my summers working in this Kaiser Aluminum Mill with these blue-collar guys. And so, you know, the 60s, yeah, not just the ideology split us, but families were torn. I mean, fathers didn't recognize their sons, and sons said hateful, spiteful things about their fathers.
That's right.
I don't think you see that now. Also, you know, you look at Jim Crow, for example, which was just abject, you know, horrible racial separation that took hold for a long, long time in the United States. We've gone past those horrible things. So when you say, what are we fighting about? You know, it's maybe a product of the fact that we live in an ephemeral age that, you know, are we fighting over how to have greater health care? Well, we're fighting over the details, you know. We don't have a common foreign foe right now, so we're fighting over, you know, how much to, right now with the Kurds, it's an important question, how much you're relying there. But macro issues, the kind of things that separated families in the 60s, I don't think exist right now.
No, exactly right. I mean, we're not involved in a war. During the Vietnam War, as you know, we were sending home 400 dead Americans every week at the height of the war, which is just extraordinary and is not like anything we've experienced even recently, even at the height of the death toll in Afghanistan and Iraq. The one thing that strikes me is that it's probably not good for America that so much of our media attention is focused on scandal and disagreement and dysfunction, which, by the way, hides the fact, for instance, that crime has gone way down since the 1970s and 80s by every measure. And yes,
you know what else has gone down in the 70s and 80s by every measure? Abortion.
That's right. And divorce. Nobody knows that. Peak year for divorce in the United States as a percentage of all marriages was 1982. It's been straight down since then. And again, our country, if you really look at it, we are so lucky to live in this country and to be alive at this moment that we are. And I think that one of the ways to begin to appreciate that is delving into our history, but also delving into the long ago history of Christianity that you do in your book, Pilgrimage to Eternity. In last terms, you have your own new piece of eternity you mentioned to me off the air. You're a new grandfather?
I'm a brand new grandfather. Thank you for giving me the chance to bore you with this. But,
no. Look, believe me, I respond to this. Go ahead.
My wife and I are lucky to have identical twin boys who've come into this world from our beautiful daughter, Sophie, and her husband, Sam. And new life is one of the greatest things of all. And believe me, it makes everything else seem pretty small when you get new life brought into your world. It's extraordinary. But thank you for giving me a chance to mention that. It does make everything pale.
Yeah, and I think about the incredible good fortune I have that my grandfathers decided to move to this country, that they came here from Germany and Russia, in the case of my grandfathers. In terms of your ancestors from Ireland, I mean, Ireland's a great place. I love visiting the country, but how lucky that your grandchildren are to be born here.
I'm product, by the way, Michael, of famine Irish, as they're called. That was the 1 in 4 Irish who either died, you know, 1 million Irish died during the Great Famine, or another 1 million who were forced to flee, some of them barefoot and illiterate, to these crowded hovels in New York City. So, of course, I feel very lucky. And I want to make one point on something you brought up about the then and now. I realized one point when I was on the Pilgrim Trail, I think it was outside of this town of Fidenza in Italy, I saw this bas-relief of these pilgrims walking barefoot with the little rucksacks over their shoulders, and it was from the 10th or 11th century. And I realized life expectancy then, do you know what it was in the medieval ages? And you know this. You'd be lucky to live to your 24th birthday.
Yeah, I mean, and even if you live that far, to live another 50 years beyond it, as you can expect to do today, that didn't exist. The book is called Pilgrimage to Eternity, written by Timothy Egan. Well worth your attention. It's posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. We will be right back on our continued pilgrimage. And on the Michael Medved Show, it is a tremendous pleasure for me to have a chance to speak to one of the foremost American historians, truly, somebody who's won a couple of Pulitzer Prizes, a National Book Award, who has had a whole spate of number one bestsellers. Joe Ellis, Joseph J. Ellis, is the author of Founding Brothers, An American Sphinx, and many other fine books. And there's a new book that's coming out in paperback, and you can get it now, which is just terrific and eye-opening, as only Joe Ellis could make it. It's called American Dialogue, The Founders and Us. And he takes a look at the ideas, the vital, I mean, electrifying ideas, and they still are, of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, and the way that those ideas, and George Washington, by the way, the way those ideas apply to contemporary debates, which where those ideas are often misused. Joe, congratulations on American Dialogue, and we've posted the book up at our website at michaelmedved.com. Let me ask you first,
Michael, it's great to be with you. What you're not telling people is we know each other from way back. And Michael was a student at Yale when I was a graduate student, and I got to teach him in one course. So this is a long friendship.
It is. And it was that was the most single memorable course of my entire educational experience, because it was colonial history taught by the unbelievably great, your mentor, Professor Edmund S. Morgan.
Yeah.
And again, it's just so terrific to see you were the teaching assistant in my section, which was lucky for me. And again, that's a consuming love for colonial history that has obviously dominated your life and changed mine. So let me go right to the founders and to some of the controversies in American dialogue. Mm-hmm. Because when you talk about the Constitution and what it means, nowhere is that more controversial than the Second Amendment, when people are talking about how this applies.
It's much more controversial now than it was then, yes.
Right. I mean, then, of course, people assumed, well, first of all, what about this notion that the Second Amendment means that you simply cannot restrict firearm ownership at all? What mm-hmm. would James Madison have thought of that?
He would have been bewildered. I mean, of course, you can't, you know, they're busy being dead. You know, they can't come and talk to us about this. We can go back to their papers, and that's what I do. But that there was a decision made in 2008, the majority opinion by Antonin Scalia, the leading originalist on the court then. He's gone to the hereafter, which did conclude that the Second Amendment provided a virtually unlimited right to own and carry a gun. And that decision overturned two centuries of federal and Supreme Court precedents. And at least as I read the evidence, is not what Madison intended when he wrote it. It's not what the members of the House or Senate meant when they passed it. It's not when the 11 states that ratified it meant when they did that. And
so what did Madison mean when he said that shall not infringe?
First of all, the Ten Amendments were not called the Bill of Rights then. The person who gave him that title is, believe it or not, Franklin Roosevelt in 1939 and 40. He was the first person to talk about the Bill of Rights. He was using it as a term to talk about the values we were going to fight World War II about. But that Madison wrote the Bill of Rights, what we call the Bill of Rights, in the spring of 1789 in order to appease those states that had ratified the Constitution quite reluctantly and had submitted recommended amendments that would be considered after the Constitution was in place, and appease them And six of the states had been very concerned about the creation of what they called a standing army. A standing army was in the tradition of the British Army or even the Continental Army, a danger to all republics. And they were worried that the Constitution would permit that. The Second Amendment was designed to relieve them of that worry by making the case that national defense would not be in the hands of a professional army, but in the hands of state militia. And that was the term bear arms, the right to bear arms, didn't mean the right to own and carry a gun. It meant the right to serve in the militia, or if you do a digital search of the 10 most prominent founders, and you can do this easily, there's about 257 occasions when the term bear arms is used. All of them mean serve in the military, either the militia or the Continental Army. So that the decision that Scalia made was a reversal and overturning of the principle of stare decisis. It was a 5-4 decision. And in my judgment, it was a kind of Alice in Wonderland travel through some labyrinth to try to come to that conclusion.
Okay, but
it was almost like...
Let's back up a little bit, because beyond the Heller case, even the Heller decision, as I remember it, by Justice Scalia, Justice Scalia doesn't argue that the purpose of the Second Amendment was to have an armed populace to protect itself against its own government.
No. He argues that it's an amendment designed to allow people
to defend themselves.
To defend themselves in this particular case, it was a Washington D.C. Case from somebody was coming into your house and
right. So, but they're not anticipating that you're going to use the Second Amendment as a license to kill cops if they come into your house or to kill soldiers if they're
No. There are quotations that the National Rifle Association developed as part of its own brochures over the years that implied that if you didn't have this right, that the government was going to come and take your guns away. And they quote Patrick Henry allegedly to say in the Virginia Ratifying Convention for the Constitution, they're going to take away your guns. And he didn't say that. What he said is they're going to take away and then the N-word, and to gales of laughter, apparently. And there was never a time in the Revolutionary War when the British Army came house to house to take people's guns away. They did go to arsenals to capture ammunition and stuff.
Okay,
the implementation of the true meaning of the Second Amendment occurred in the Militia Act of 1792, right after it was ratified. It was the Militia Act said that every able-bodied man between the ages of 19 or 18 and 49 must purchase a musket and an outfit, meaning a gun belt and boots, so that the real meaning of the Second Amendment is not that you have a right to own a gun, but that you have an obligation to serve.
And by the way, what's fascinating about this is that two of the countries that are famous for having almost universal military service in Switzerland and Israel, they have the same idea, which is, yes, you have a right to have a gun if you've served in the military. But for other people, it's far more restricted. We are just about out of time, Joe. The book is called American Dialogue, The Founders and Us. There's so much more here about economic policy, about the power of government, about limitations on government, and limitations on liberty and the view of the founders and how it's so highly relevant today. You will find it fascinating. It's important. It's posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. It's just coming out in paperback. American Dialogue, The Founders and Us by the great former teacher of mine, Joseph J. Ellis. We will be right back on The Medved Show. And on the Michael Medved Show, I know one of the things that I've done from time to time that I get good feedback from, so I'm about to do it again, is to tell you some of my favorite quotes. And one of my favorite quotes is from Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said, "Any lasting institution is nothing more than the shadow of one man." And I think about that in relation to MyPillow. Why that? Because this is an amazing American company. It's an amazing American success story, but it's really the shadow of one man. His name is Mike Lindell, and a lot of you know him because of this great product, and I know so many of you have actually expressed thanks for my making you aware of MyPillow. But there's also a story behind it. Mike, I appreciate the fact that this is not only a great American business, but it's a great American story in terms of your story. And I understand this is the 10th anniversary of your being clean. Explain to all the listeners why that's so important.
Well, I mean, I got to take them back real quick. I was a cocaine addict for since the early 80s and switched to crack cocaine in the early 2000s. And when I invented my pillow in late 2004, I was still an addict then, and lost a 20-year marriage, had people taking the company, everything. I was turned down everywhere when I had been in my pillow. And it got to be 2008, and I had I even had the drug dealers do an intervention where I couldn't buy I'd been up for 14 days, and I couldn't buy they all did this intervention. He said, you need to go to bed, we're cutting you off. And I went down to the streets at 2 a.m. and couldn't buy crack anywhere, and came back up. And one of the dealers says to me, he says, "How'd that work out for you?" He said, "Give me your phone. I'm going to take your picture. You've been telling us for years now that this pillow is just a platform for God, and you're going to come back and help us all someday, and we're not going to let you die on us." And that you go through 2008, and in December of 2008, a friend of mine came to me that was my equal. He had started cocaine at the same time, switched to crack at the same time. But he had been clean for 3 years, had found Jesus. He came to me, and I hadn't seen him in a year. And I said, "Dick," I said, what are you doing here?" He says, "Well, the Lord led me here." And he said, "What's going on?" I said, "Well, as long as you're here," I said, "is it boring?" And he said, "No, man, it's not boring." And about a month and a half later, on January 16, 2009, that's the day I said that I knew everything was going on. My pillow was just like a TV, like the old TVs you turn off and that little dot gets real small, and then you turn it back on and it would come back, and that was my life. And I said a prayer that day, and I said, "You know, God, I want to wake up and not have the desire for all these drugs and addictions again." And that was 10 years ago today. And now, I woke up that day. I also, I had this peaceful feeling and started on this incredible journey of transformation and salvation.
Well, and meanwhile, MyPillow has been able to transform whole communities and the lives of many other people. How many employees do you have now?
Well, it's funny. It's in 2011. Nobody would take my pillow, and I did an infomercial. We did it ourselves with a real audience, and when that aired in October 7, 2011, I went from 5 employees to 500 in 40 days, and now today I have over 1,600 employees, sold over 44 million pillows. But my passion has always been to help people, and I've been very blessed by what the product has done. But more important to me is the platform that I have now. And I'm using that. I was just, I become friends with the president. He just signed an amazing opiate bill, 800-page opiate bill. A couple months ago, I was there at the White House with him. And I'm coming out with a network. It's called the Lindell Recovery Network, that's going to have all these stories of hope like mine, where you put in your age, what you're addicted to. Let's say you're a 22-year-old opiate addict. All these stories where these guys your age that have made it through are going to come down, and that's going to give you hope where you might not be able to relate to a 50-year-old meth addict or a 40-year-old alcoholic, but you can relate to your peers, whatever that is. So all these stories come down, and then we're going to have all the help centers that I have vetted, faith-based, most, you know, Salvation Army, Teen Challenge, Union Gospel, all over the country. So I'm going to be like a tour guide and say, hey, guys, go over here. This works for you. This is going to work. And when they get out of there, I'm going to have paid mentors. They're going to help them all across the country, and we're going to beat this. I'm going to fulfill what I told those drug dealers way back 10 years ago, that I would, through God, I would come back and help them and get them, you know, try and beat this terrible epidemic we're facing.
It's what a terrific commitment that is, and how important that is. And I know you have a book coming out. The book is coming out sometime next year.
No, it's going to come out in probably no later than 3 months. It's called What Are the Odds? From Crack Addict to CEO, and it's going to help so many people. It's going to be absolutely amazing. It's hopefully I can, and I'm going to use money from that to finance the recovery network. So it's all going to come full circle.
Well, good for you. And if I can just mention, before I knew your story, I knew your product, and I just loved it. And it is one of those things where people who are enthusiastic about MyPillow, it's kind of a bonus that you get this great pillow, which by the way, do want to urge people to check out. They can go directly to MyPillow.com. And you offer such good deals for our folks. Mention, by the way, the promo code MEDVED. That's certainly a way of getting a special discount on their 4-pack right now. But Mike Lindell, coming up for our country right now, and I know this is on your heart too, there is so much with the shutdown going on of the back and forth and sides basically saying to the other side, you're just pure evil. What would you urge Americans to do to open our hearts a little bit, to try to get together and work together on some of what we need to do to help our country?
I think everybody's got to look at common sense and not look at everything so political. This is an absolute disgrace. And I'm saying this for the Democrats, because I'm saying there's no reason when every single person going all the way back wanted money for this for our border security. You need a country. This needs to be, this is peanuts compared to what it costs. For me, it's all about the drugs. I know where these drugs come from. It's getting into our cities, and it's just been, it's an epidemic. And I just think there's got to be, we've got to let it play out, but they've got to come to common sense. It's the only common sense solution. We need to do it now, and then we need to, after that's done, then get together and come up with a great thing here for the illegals that are here. Maybe give them, get them visas. They don't become citizens, but at least they can work here legally and everything. And I mean, there's solutions that are out there that are common sense that they, but both sides that fight over which, we don't want that. We don't want that.
Maybe just a thought. It doesn't help anybody to shut down the government. It's just one of those things I wish that politicians on both sides wouldn't consider anymore. But I hope you will consider checking out MyPillow. If you go to MyPillow.com, or you can call them. We have a toll-free number. It's 800-320-6280. That's 800-320-6280. 800-320-6280. Mike Lindell, keep on keeping on, making contributions not only to your great company, but to the country that has made it all possible. And actually, when you read about his story and you hear about his story, should be a powerful reminder to everybody that we are and we remain the greatest nation on God's green earth.